Today is a sad day as we heard about the passing of the legendary Dame Maggie Smith. Katie and I had the honor of talking about her twice on the podcast. Once in episode 26, when Professor Minerva McGonagall was paired with Jane Austen, and once in episode 216, where Dame Maggie Smith herself was paired with Shonda Rhimes. I cut together in this tribute episode the pieces about McGonagall and about Maggie Smith herself. If you would like to listen to the full episodes, you can find them on herstoryontherocks.com.
All right.
What do you know about Minerva McGonagall? Because this is going to be so fun. So fun.
Okay. So as I said, I did read the books twice, and I'm a big fan of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, and I have seen all the movies, but honestly, like, I'm not very good at going in deep on things, but I
Katie's
do know.
Not a fangirl.
I'm not a fangirl, but I do enjoy her, and she's one of my favorite characters. I know that Maggie Smith plays her. I know that she tries very hard to be fair, but she obviously favors Gryffindor in the
course.
Trio.
Like,
but I feel like she really tries to like not let it take over like Snape does.
Right.
And I know that there is some confusion as to how old she really is and things like that because of the new movie that came out. It kind of messed things up. And I know that she's an Animagus. And there's just like, you know, I know all these like little things about her, but I feel like I don't know like her real full story.
Yeah. I'm excited to string it together. Yes. So obviously we were all initially introduced to McGonagall from book McGonagall, like number 1 to 7. And then we really got into her in the movies. And I think the movies always kind of have her in the background, but she's not as integral of a part as she is in the books. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't done a reread in a while, you forget how much she's in the books and how important she is in the books. Mm-hmm. So I want to point that out. And this story comes from the books, but then right after the last book was published and the last movie came out, people were like begging J.K. Rowling for like more info. So she started the website Pottermore. Mm-hmm. And the original purpose of Pottermore was she was publishing essays about backgrounds of each of the characters. So if you wanted to get on, you could read like, here's Lupin's backstory from the time he was born. Mm-hmm. Here's this. So that's where I got a lot of the information. So what I'm doing is excluding things that she did in like video games and things like Lego McGonagall Harry Potter video game.
Yeah.
If she said something on there, it doesn't count.
No.
If I excluded Cursed Child because J.K. Rowling did not write that. Mm-hmm. Anything she wrote, she approved it, but she didn't write it. So anything she wrote, I'm taking into account. Barring,
word of God.
Yes, word of God. Barring Fantastic Beasts, because this series is not over yet. So I don't know what additions she's going to make. And McGonagall appeared for 30 seconds in the second one as about a 20-year-old. But in the real grand scheme of the actual story of McGonagall, she would not have been born yet.
Yeah.
So that's frustrating.
Yes.
Okay. So that is a little background for everybody. This is where I'm getting this information. I'm not making it up in my head. This is all existing.
This is not Allie's fan fiction.
Right, exactly. This is real life things that J.K. Rowling wrote on paper. Minerva McGonagall was the eldest of three children and the only daughter. So she has two younger brothers, and she is a half-blood. For people who don't know, it's kind of like being mixed. She's got a parent who's magical and a parent who's not magical. Her father is non-magical. He is a Presbyterian minister. His name is Reverend Robert McGonagall. And her mother is a Hogwarts-educated witch named Isabel Rose. Minerva's parents are a really important part of why she grew up to be the stern, kind of fair, but cold, but also unfair person that she is. So we're going to start with them. Her parents grow up in this really small village, and all the neighbors thought that Isabel every year would go off to this prestigious boarding school for girls when she's actually going to
Hogwarts
Wizarding School. And her parents were not into Muggles. At the time when she was born, there was still a big like anti-Muggle prejudice. People were like, no, you're like a lesser being than us as witches and wizards. But she falls deeply in love. Isabel falls deeply in love with Robert, and they get eloped at age 18.
Whoa.
And her parents are like furious. Mm-hmm. But the issue is she hasn't told Robert that she's a witch, and she doesn't want to like mar the honeymoon with this information.
Yeah.
So she's like, okay, I'm just going to hide my powers for a little bit. And then a little bit turned into a really long time. And then it was like, now I don't know what to do because we've been married for super long.
Mm-hmm.
So she kind of freaks out in early 1935 when she finds out that she's pregnant. And she's really overjoyed, but then she's also like, this is a crisis because my baby is going to have magic and babies can't hold it in the way that adults can. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a really big problem. She has the baby, names the baby Minerva, which is obviously not a biblical name.
Yeah.
She's born on October 4th, 1935. And her husband, Robert, has to continually explain to everybody why she picked such a weird non-biblical name for the name of the Reverend's first child.
Mm-hmm.
She's very moody while she has this newborn. She's very worried. And Robert's starting to get concerned with how his wife is acting. And he doesn't realize at the time that it's because Isabel is already seeing signs that Minerva is not only a witch, but an extraordinarily powerful one. So she'll walk in the room and toys that were like up on a top shelf will be down on the floor. Her father's bagpipes will play from the other room when no one's in there. And best, the family's cat does her bidding. So this little tiny infant is like controlling the house. So Isabel has to very patiently sit down Robert and explain, oh, P.S., I'm a witch.
Oh,
I've always been a witch. Our daughter is a witch. If we have any more children, they will also most likely be magical. And he is like, this lie has gone on too long. Like, I'm a pastor. Like, I can't be married to a witch, like, at this time in history. But he also can't get divorced because at this time in history, that would have been seen as super, you know, unethical for a pastor to get divorced. Mm-hmm. So they just have this cold relationship. So Minerva is growing up in a household watching her parents just exist near each other and not really be in love and kind of be mad at each other because, you know, they're resenting each other for what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this cold lack of trust.
Mm.
She was taught because of that never to flaunt her magic. No matter how powerful she is, you just kind of do your thing, which is how Minerva is. And she also was taught to hide the mistakes her little brothers made so their dad wouldn't think magic is such a big deal. So if one of the brothers made a mistake with their magic, it was her job to like swoop in and fix it real quick with hers so that the mom could like get the dad out of the room and it wouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah.
Through all this, she does stay super close with both of her parents, and it turns out that she ends up resembling both of them in some odd ways. Her mother, she resembles like with her brilliant magic, and her father, she resembles in his strict piety as a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And on her 11th birthday, of course, she gets the letter that she is accepted to Hogwarts. And she's so excited to be in a place where she doesn't have to hide her magic. But her first day is tougher than you would think because she is one of the rare instances of a hat stall, which is great. The Sorting Hat has no idea where to put her and sits on her head for 5.5 minutes attempting to decide. So you've got this little first year sitting there. What houses do you think?
All right. I think Slytherin and Gryffindor.
Nope.
Ravenclaw and Gryffindor?
Ravenclaw and Gryffindor. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I only say Slytherin because like I feel like she has the ability to like be very like cunning. And like, I don't know. And that's the thing because like,
all the houses could be anything, right?
Like,
I
know.
Any kid.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Because that's the thing. I'm technically a Slytherin. Mm. And it's something I would never think of for myself.
Right.
But then, you know, it kind of makes sense, especially because Caroline's a Slytherin, too.
Yeah.
And I see so many similarities between us.
Yeah.
But then again, as we know now, number one, the Sorting Hat does take your opinion into consideration.
Yes, it does.
And number two, I loved this. We learned this in Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. It also takes into consideration where it wants you to grow.
Right.
Which I love.
Because it could be your technical, like, weak area, the area that it thinks right. you need more confidence in.
Yeah.
So Minerva McGonagall is obviously super smart and logical. Mm-hmm. Maybe she needs to be courageous and brave.
It reminds right? me so much of Hermione. Like yeah. Hermione's journey.
Duh.
Also, 5.5 minutes. If we sat in silence for 5.5 minutes.
With everybody in the school staring at you.
That would be, it is so long.
It is. Fun factoid. Flitwick, Professor Flitwick, was mm-hmm. also a Hatstall Ravenclaw Ooh. Gryffindor, and they often joked about how they could have switched their jobs because he's the head of Ravenclaw House. Yeah. And she's the head of- That's a little insider tidbit for the Harry Potter listeners out there. Anyway, she becomes one of the most outstanding students of her year. She is extraordinarily skilled at the most difficult class, which is Transfiguration, under her teacher, Professor Dumbledore, at the mm-hmm. time, not headmaster. She gets top scores on all of her wizarding tests. She becomes a prefect. She's head girl. She gets an article written about her in Transfiguration Today. And then her professor, Dumbledore, helps her register and teaches her to become an animagus, where she learns how to transform into a tabby cat. She's also an extraordinarily gifted Quidditch player, and she played for the Gryffindor Quidditch team, but in her seventh year, she suffered a major injury on the Quidditch pitch that included broken bones and a concussion, and she's like in the hospital wing for a really long time, and she never plays again, which is interesting because broken bones and a concussion, like, you know they can fix that like, right. as wizards, so it's like, was it emotional damage? At yes. this sporting injury.
Yeah, probably that.
And, yeah.
Because, like, that would just be very traumatizing.
Uh-huh.
Like.
Because Slytherin won.
Mm, yeah.
After she hurt herself. And then she hates them forever. This is, like, it's great. Yeah, it would be totally traumatizing as a senior in high school. It's, like, something you're really excited about. You've always wanted to win. It's your last chance. Mm. You know, it's the Oliver Wood complex.
Right.
And then it's, like, you get injured and it destroys the team.
Right.
What do you do?
Right.
It's horrible. Mm. I'm sure people have had stuff like that happen at school.
Right.
I feel like our friend Amanda Helmick had that happen. Remember?
Yes, she did. I think she like tore like a hamstring yeah. or something.
And like crushed a bone in her thigh. Yeah. She was like getting scholarships to go to college to play soccer. Yeah. And all that was taken away.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I like that is the one like huge scary thing about putting everything in a sport.
Mm-hmm.
Like it could just be taken away so quickly. Actually, I did a job this week for a former Ravens player.
Really?
Yeah. And he
Ray
is...
Rice?
No, I would have burned his house down. Just kidding.
just kidding. That was not a threat.
No, it wasn't. And it was just because he beat his wife.
Yeah.
And he... But yeah, he was a Ravens player. And he is not that old. But he had a really bad injury.
Mm.
And then he had to retire.
It's crazy.
In like his 30s.
Right. And it's like, what do you do? Like, where's your money
He had his
from?
First kid yesterday.
Oh, my God.
I know because I was supposed to pick up the test at his house. And they're like, oh, we can't come. We're in, my wife's in labor. It's like, okay.
That sounds good.
I was like, oh, so you're not going to drop everything at the hospital to come meet me here so I can pick up your radon test?
Clearly, I have something to do. Yeah. Yeah. So she graduates and she gets a job at the Ministry of Magic, but she's going to take it 2 months and like have her summer break and then go and work there.
Holiday.
These 2 months, though, she kind of loses her head a little bit because she falls head over heels in love with Dougal McGregor. Dougal.
What a name. Sounds very like Scottish. I guess it's Scottish, not Irish.
I guess.
I think that's Scottish.
And is McGregor the name of the guy?
Peter Rabbit.
Is it?
Mr. McGregor is Peter Rabbit's
enemy. Okay. I was like, I feel like that's a British name that I should know.
McGregor. Yeah, I think McGregor is very British.
Okay. So he's a handsome muggle farmer boy from her village, and they shared a sense of humor. They were an attractive young couple. They would argue fiercely and see these like deep mysteries in each other. And before she knows it, Dougal is like on one knee proposing to her in the middle of a field, and she accepts. Gosh. And she's like, oh my gosh, I have to go home and tell my parents. I'm so excited. I'm so in love with this boy. And she walks in, and like her parents are just like sitting there silently at the table, and she's like, holy shit, I can't do this. I can't marry a muggle because I will be like them.
Oh my God.
I can't lie to my husband and lock my wand in a box and like live this secret life forever. So she can't tell Dougal why, because of the international statute of secrecy. If she breaks that, she's going to lose her job at the ministry. So she slips away from her parents' house, tells Dougal she can't marry him with no explanation, and then just leaves for the ministry totally heartbroken. He's heartbroken. She's heartbroken. And it's just traumatizing to her. She works at the ministry for 2 years and is extremely unhappy. And they're not quite sure, like, is it because of this horrible heartbreak?
Yeah.
Is it because of all the anti-Muggle bias that, like, exists at the ministry at that time? And she's like, I'm a half-blood. My dad's a Muggle. Like, I don't want to do this work. But her boss, Elphinstone, is very impressed and taken by her and offers her a prestigious promotion. But she turns it down. She's like, I cannot be here. I don't like it here. And she sends a message to her old mentor, who recently turned from professor to headmaster, Dumbledore. And she asks for a teaching position. And because he just left the Transfiguration position, he's like, sure, take my job. We'd love to have you come back. Because again, she's a super skilled witch. Shortly after returning to Hogwarts, Minerva got word from her village that Dougal got married to somebody else. And Albus Dumbledore discovers her in tears in her classroom late one night, and she confesses the entire story to him, and Albus sits down and offers back some of his secrets. And she is one of the only people who knows about his homosexual relationship with Grindelwald and about his sister's death. So they become each other's best friends and work confidants, and they work together through obviously multiple horrible situations, but it was this one night that made their friendship like lasting and mutual.
Yeah.
Which is so cute.
Ugh. Cause I do feel like it's such a tangible thing throughout the whole books. Like they have this very strong unspoken bond.
And
like,
it appears totally platonic too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's
you never doubt it.
No, it's like this beautiful relationship. They trust each other. They love each other. He's a little bit condescending to her sometimes, which I'm going to bring up tenfold, but it's like you can tell that they're good friends.
Yeah.
And I love that. So Minerva remains friends with her old boss, Elphinstone. And on one of his visits to the school, he proposes to her.
Whoa.
But she's still in love with Dougal. She doesn't care that he's married to someone else and has kids and stuff. So she turns him down. And Elphinstone doesn't give up. He proposes to her every now and then for like the next couple of years.
Oh, my gosh.
And at that time, if you guys haven't read the Harry Potter series, Voldemort is obviously the bad guy, but Voldemort was also the bad guy long before that. So he's rising to power for the first time, and she doesn't join the Order of the Phoenix during the first war. She carries messages back and forth as a tabby cat, but that's like as much as she does, because obviously we know Dumbledore is doing like a lot more things. During this time, she loses many of her beloved students to wars, and also Dougal dies because of an anti-Muggle raid.
Oh, no.
And she's like just so heartbroken that now this love of her life is dead. Like, he's not even just married to somebody else. He is dead. And the opening scene of Harry Potter, the very first scene of the book, she is the first character, like wizarding character, described as the tabby cat sitting outside the Dursleys' house. And the first dialogue is Dumbledore speaking to her in cat form. So you come in and Lily and James Potter have just been murdered, and she comes out of her cat form and she's like, is it true? Are they dead? And of course Dumbledore's like, yes, they're dead. And they're her previous students. Like, she loves them. She taught them. They were great kids. And she says, we can't leave this baby here. These are the worst types of Muggles imaginable. And that means something coming from a woman who grew up with Muggles. Like, she knows, and she hates the Dursleys. And of course, just like he always does, Dumbledore ignores her opinion. So she is constantly protecting or attempting to voice Harry's safety throughout the books. And the male teachers are constantly ignoring her requests to protect this child, which is very important, I think, to an unmarried, unchilded woman.
Right.
Is constantly being just ignored.
Right. And it's also like, it's just so interesting to me that it's not like, oh, I don't think he'll be like safe. Like, they don't, like, they're not very like, you know, attentive parents. It's like, she knows that they are mentally, she was like, he is going to be mentally abused in this place. And I don't want that to happen to him because that's like so terrible.
Right.
Like, oh, it just makes me so mad that she like knew what was going to happen. And maybe that's why like that bond with Harry grew from very far away his whole life.
Yeah.
Like,
and it just, it is, it's sad that sometimes like, I think women attempt to speak for children a lot, and sometimes it gets just really brushed off. Yeah. And, you know, it's not that women necessarily have a deeper connection, you know, with a child than a man does. I just think that in this case, she was attempting to speak for him, and Dumbledore was intending to fix the Wizarding World instead of just like this one child.
Right.
So. Crucial. Over the next 11 years, when he's growing up with the Dursleys, it says that she visits every so often in cat form to like keep an eye on him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dougal is passed away. So the next time Elphinstone proposes, she says yes. And she, in J.K. Rowling's words, always something of a feminist, keeps her last name. So she does not change her last name to his, which people thought was really weird because he was a pureblood. And they were like, don't you want to be a part of that line? And she's like, no, I'm a McGonagall. This is me. Back up. So people did think that was strange. One of her brothers was also killed during the first Wizarding War. And so in this time, she's spending a lot of time with her nieces and nephews. Both of her brothers had kids, and that's really fulfilling to her. She loves that. And after 3 years of marriage, Elphinstone unexpectedly dies from a venomous spider bite.
Oh my gosh.
After only 3 years, and they were living in this really cute cottage. And she's just torn up by emotions, and she can't bear to stay in the cottage. So she moves back into Hogwarts, into her little stone bedroom. And that is where she stays in the castle all the time with the kids. And she pours all of her love into her students and her work. And no one but Albus Dumbledore ever knew how much she struggled. So as we now are kind of crossing into the original Harry Potter books, that's like the Pottermore stuff that J.K. Rowling wrote afterwards. I want to point out that in every single book, while Dumbledore is out gallivanting, doing whatever shit he's doing, she is the acting deputy headmistress at the school. She is second in command. And every time he steps foot out of that building, which is often, she is working there as the headmaster. Sometimes she's working as the headmaster without the title because the ministry are pieces of shit.
It's also, so funny that exact thing happened in my tiny Christian school.
Did it really?
Yes.
You have somebody who's actually in charge when somebody else is. Okay.
So we had Wild Bill. He was literally a park ranger who became the headmaster of our school. And that's what we called it, too, the headmaster. And there's not that many students, but he was like super wild, like always bringing animals into the school. He would leave, like he was supposed to be my physics teacher because he's like, I'm the only one qualified to do it. I don't know how that happened, but he was like, I'm the only one qualified to do it. But then he just gave us a homeschool textbook and was like, here, teach yourselves. And I was like,
physics is really hard.
Physics is really hard. So anyways, and then, because he would be like off doing crazy things, the English teacher, Mrs. Greenlee, would just be stuck like making all the decisions. And she was acting headmistress or whatever the whole time, basically, without the title and without the pay and doing all his work. And it was very frustrating. And like, not all the time, but like most of the time and just not getting credit.
And so he gave you a book and wanted you to learn from it. Is that? Is that Umbridge?
Oh my gosh, yes.
She does.
Well, and the thing was too, like his grading system didn't make any sense because like, number one, I cheated off of the boy next to me, Ryan, who was such a sweetheart for letting me do this because I literally just did not understand him.
Ryan,
he was super smart.
A plus Ryan?
I know. He is real sweet.
Good job.
And we literally, because I knew we had the same answers because I cheated off him and wrote the same exact things down.
You didn't even change
and
some of it?
No.
You're a bad cheater.
And I would get better grades than him. How is that possible? It's physics. It's numbers.
Poor Ryan. Sorry, Ryan.
Yeah, he just like liked me more.
That's
he literally
crazy.
Caught a bunch of boys smoking pot in my car and was like, oh, but it's Katie Greenwood, so it's fine.
It's fine.
I was like, I don't know what I did for you, but this
she
is weird.
Wild Bill.
Wild Bill.
She didn't mean it.
I don't know.
Didn't mean it.
Anyways, so that's my little short vignette.
Yep. Love it. Also in every book, she is with Dumbledore and Snape when they are making almost every important decision, excepting the one where, you know, Snape is being a double agent. But except that one, she's pretty much always there. And her opinion is constantly overlooked. Dumbledore is always siding with Snape, which is extraordinarily frustrating. Mm-hmm. So in Philosopher's Stone, the first time you see her not as a cat, she's the stern woman I explained earlier. She's sorting the kids. But then the next time you see her, she's breaking the rules to get Harry onto the Quidditch team. You know, and it's like this really interesting thing where she is willing to do what she can to make sure that her house has the best sports team, which is a very fun trait in a person, but also unfair because schools do this a lot and give kids who are athletes a break on stuff that they don't give other kids a break on. So I want to point that out. She then buys Harry a Nimbus 2000, his first broom, and a very expensive broom with her small teaching salary. And that was a very kind gesture, knowing that, hey, he doesn't have anybody that's going to help him out with this. And, you know, this whole book is about protecting the Philosopher's Stone, at the time, Sorcerer's Stone, if you're American. And the kids get really worried about it, and they run into her, and they're like, where's Dumbledore? We have something to tell him. And she's like, he's gone, but anything you can tell him, you can tell me. And they just kind of disregard that. And then she is the person who transfigured the chess set to be movable people. That was her contribution to the protection of the Sorcerer's Stone. So that's like a really big, of all the challenges they had to do, like, that one is massive. So then by the time we get to Chamber of Secrets, the first time we see her, it's after the car crashes into the Whomping Willow and they get all battered around, and Snape finds Harry and Ron outside, and she catches Snape in the hallway, who is about to just like give them the worst detention I'm sure ever. And she just takes them to her office and gives them a plate of sandwiches that constantly refills itself, which is adorable. And I love it. And this is like a very muscles twitching in your mouth book for her, because there is a very gloaty, self-centered mansplainer of a teacher this year named Gilderoy Lockhart. And anytime he says something, like, the book describes her just like clenching and like shaking, because he's always talking down to her in many different occasions. And Dumbledore actually in this book gets removed from the school. The school board votes him out of the school. She is the headmaster. But then when everybody gets saved from the massive snake in the basement, she's in the office with the Weasleys. Like, your daughter's alive. Everything's great. Dumbledore comes in and tells her, Minerva, go down to the kitchens and organize a celebratory feast. That's his line to her. She has been the headmistress for months while he's been kicked out, or at least a month.
Right.
And her job is to go make sure that there's food ready.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bit condescending in that sense. And then we get to our third book, and there's a lot of positive girl interaction here. This is when McGonagall gives Hermione the time turner, which is, hey, I'm me. I'm super smart. You're you. You're super smart. I'm going to help you out. We're going to figure out this thing so that you can be the best teacher ever. She's also notably on edge about Sirius Black and is constantly like yelling about trying to protect Harry Potter to a lot of people. And she also has some negative girl interaction, which I want to know what you think about this one. Her behavior towards Professor
Trelawney,
who teaches divination, I think is deplorable.
Yeah.
She thinks that Trelawney is less than her because she teaches future telling instead of something that's logical.
And I've never liked that, because Hermione does the same exact thing.
Yes. To Parvati and Lavender.
Yeah. And it's because it is something you just have to be naturally talented at. And I think that is something that is so hard for someone like McGonagall and Hermione, who it's like, no, but like, with my brain power, I should be able to do anything. I can do anything I want. But it's like with this, like, you either have the sight or you don't.
Yeah.
So then I think that their initial reaction is to look down on it.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, well, it must not be worth anything if, like, you know, it's not accessible to everyone.
Right. Clearly, it's not true.
Right.
You must be faking.
Right. Exactly. And it has always bothered me that, like, because poor Professor Trelawney.
I know. And the crazy thing, like, they get into, like, a drunk fight in this book, like, at the dinner table. It's crazy. Mm. And also, deep Harry Potter tidbit, if you trace back all of her Trelawney's predictions that she says in class, they all happen. So, like, amazing. at that drunken fight at the kitchen in the Christmas scene, she says the next person to stand up and leave this room is going to be the next person to die. And Dumbledore stands up and he's like the next person from the people at that table to die. Oof. So, like, there's so many things that you're like, J.K. Rowling, you're a devil.
Yeah.
Like, every time. Anyway, sorry.
Well, it almost reminds you, like, it kind of feels like East Coast elitism. And
it is.
In, like, a pure
the
way.
The ivory towers.
The ivory tower of, like, no, like, we have universities with, like, you know, we learn. Whereas, like,
and
West Coast
Johns
is more
Hopkins,
like.
Right.
And, like,
so
West
smart.
Coast seems more like, no, like, you know, we're more spiritual and, like, you know, whatever. And, like, I don't know. But I'm also putting that onto everything I ever see.
So it's like studying it's like studying medicine versus studying like theology.
Yes.
It's like, well, how is that a thing? It's
just
theories about religious practice.
Right, exactly.
Like, yeah, it's crazy. So I think that happens a lot between women, and I wanted to point it out because it's not fun.
Right.
So she's also a girl into sports, and when Gryffindor wins the cup that year, it says that McGonagall is noticeably sobbing, which I think is great, knowing about her sports injury, that she is like noticeably impassioned about them winning. But in the next series of books, Goblet of Fire, Harry is put in pretty much the fucking Hunger Games at his school, where he has to fight to the death against like crazy magic as like a kid. And this is where she makes that famous line, like, what, we should offer him up as bait? Are you kidding me? And that's against Crouch and Dumbledore, and they're like, yeah, I think we should just go for it. But also in this book, when there's this whole tournament going on where there's going to be two guest schools, she is tasked with the job of making the castle appropriate and teaching the kids how to dance. So it is her job to make sure that all of the like floofy things are happening. In a rare instance of non-school-esque behavior, her and Dumbledore share a dance at the Yule Ball, which is very, very cute. And she also loans out her classroom to Harry to practice for the tournament with Hermione, because she knows he just doesn't have the chops and like somebody's got to do something. So that's she, nice. she, Dumbledore, and Snape end up being the ones who rescue Harry from the Death Eater at the end in his office, in Crouch's office, or Mad-Eye Moody, fake Mad-Eye Moody.
Right.
And Dumbledore leaves and leaves her there with Crouch and tells her to watch him. The Minister of Magic comes in and overrules her and takes Barty Crouch to get the Dementor's kiss, which leaves no proof that Voldemort is back. And the quote is, Harry says she screamed more than he had ever seen before. And so she is like fighting back against the, for all intents and purposes, the president. And he's just like not listening to her. And
well, because
like,
I'm sure like, and she sees the long term goal of it.
Right.
She's like, no, you don't understand. Like, we need him as evidence. And he's like, basing all his decisions off of like that gut emotional reaction. Like, no, I hate this person. Look what he did. I need to him to give the Dementor's kiss.
Right.
Like,
which is pretty much the death sentence.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So by Order of the Phoenix, which is the fifth book, she has to endure another woman who knows nothing about education come in and tell her how to teach. Ooh. This is another clench her jaw book for McGonagall. She is constantly like, how do you expect to see how I teach if you're constantly cutting me off and telling me what to do? She keeps her cool. She has an icy exterior, but she goes beyond anything she could possibly do to find little ways to annoy Umbridge, like encouraging the Weasley twins and like telling the ghost Peeves like ways that he can destroy things in her office. Like, she is being very catty and I love it. And Professor Dumbledore gets arrested in this book. And in the movie, this doesn't happen, but in the book, she pulls out her wand in the office and is pretty much like, if you're taking him, you're taking me too. She is fully prepared to duel the Minister of Magic in Dumbledore's office, like, to save him. And he's like, nah, 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 stay here. I gotta go. You need to be with these people. Mm-hmm. And Umbridge, being the horrible racist that she is, tries to get one of the half-breed teachers removed from the school in the middle of the night. And we see McGonagall running down the hill screaming, like, how dare you? How dare you let him go? And before they even, and this is like a shot to the back, pretty much, before they even show that they're dueling, her wand's not even out, she gets hit with 4 stunning spells in the chest, at which she is completely inactive for the first time in all of the series. She leaves the school. This is the only time we see her not in that school building doing her school things. And Pomfrey, the nurse, says, they did that at night because they never could have hit her in the day. They're like, ooh, there is no chance that would have happened. But she's in the hospital for months, and she returns at the end of the book with the aid of a walking stick. So this is the first time we see her very weak.
That really fucked her up.
Yeah, it super fucked her up. And it's not in the movie at all, which is such a cool scene of her, like, defending the school when Dumbledore is gone. But we don't get to see that, unfortunately. Maybe in the redo in 30 years. Hopefully Maggie Smith will still be alive.
Yeah.
So... And Half-Blood Prince, this is the 6th book. She's, like, not in it a lot. She's, like, doing school things. And, you know, when Katie Bell gets, like, cursed by a crazy necklace, like, she's there and stuff. But it's the least of involvement from her, because that book is about Dumbledore and Harry going off and doing crazy things to, like, figure out what's going on with Voldemort.
Yeah.
But at the end of the book, her best friend is murdered in the building that she is in by her former student and colleague. And she's just, like, an emotional wreck. This is, like, the worst thing that could happen to her. But she leads the funeral. She takes over the school. The quote in the book is, Professor McGonagall had risen to her feet, and the mournful hum in the great hall died away at once. Mm. So as soon as she stood up, everybody was like, we're on board. We love you. We want to hear what you have to say. So she thinks she's going to be the headmistress, and she takes over. But at the beginning of book 7, the unthinkable happens, and Voldemort, super, super bad guy, takes over the school and appoints Snape as headmaster. And she refuses to leave. This is not safe for her. Yeah. She is working with the man who killed her best friend and has to take orders from him and has to watch people use corporal punishment on her students, the only people she cares about. And she has to stay there and just constantly fend people off and protect the students, right? All these little kids who she loves. And when we don't see a lot of her because we're off with Harry and Ron and Hermione doing their thing. But when the kids get back to the school, she is disheveled. She is beaten down. Her bun is loosened. She's like not the woman she used to be. And Harry is pretty much like, yo, Voldy and his army, they're on their way. And I need to find something.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to do. And she's like, we'll buy you time. And the other professors are like, we're never going to win. And she goes, we'll buy him time. So she goes into this fight assuming she's going to die. So she goes in. She gets all the kids safe. She gets the kids evacuated that are under legal age. She allows kids to stay that are old enough that want to fight. And she starts fighting. She puts up the army. She transfigures all the soldiers. She charms some desks to, like, turn into army people to go fight. And she pulls off, like, some incredible magic. She duels Snape. She duels the Karos, which are 2 other Death Eaters that are there. And it's just incredible knowing that she's doing this all in the effort to, like, get Harry Potter where he needs to be.
Yeah.
Because she knows that her late best friend gave him a job. And she's, like, using her loyalty to Dumbledore to fix this. So when Harry fake dies, she is described as having, the narrator describes her scream as a blood-curdling scream that was far beyond that of Ginny, Ron, and Hermione combined. So her pain at seeing Harry's limp body is like, this cannot be happening. And when Harry later on is not dead and actually wins, McGonagall, it says, is one of the first people to reach him. And the last scene we see her in, it says that she uncharacteristically wraps her arms around him in a deep hug, like right over top of, you know, Voldemort's corpse, pretty much.
Right.
And that's the last we have of her in the books being like, yes, we fucking did it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm alive. You're alive. We've lost a lot of kids. We've lost a lot of people. We've lost a lot of really awesome people, friends,
yeah,
coworkers, but we've got this. She later becomes the headmistress of the school. And we know this is the only time I'll mention Cursed Child. She was still the headmistress in Cursed Child. So we know she at least lives another 12 years.
Yeah.
And, the new Minister of Magic, Kingsley Shacklebolt, gives her Order of Merlin First Class for her work in the Wizarding War. Mm. And because Neville Longbottom becomes a professor there, we know that she hires him because she's the headmistress, which that's really fun to think about.
I love that.
And the last thing I want to say about her, a quote from the book that I think is beautiful. Obviously, all these quotes are from J.K. Rowling, which I think is the important part about they are being written by a woman who purposely changed her name on the front of a book because she knew they wouldn't sell if it was a woman. She's writing about this woman who is constantly being overridden by men. So in the last scene, she is giving pretty much a death speech. They have 1 hour to live if they don't turn over Harry. And it says, every eye, living and dead, was fixed upon Professor McGonagall, who was speaking from the raised platform at the top of the hall. And I think that is such a beautiful one sentence of, it's just like every fucking person in that building, the grown-ups, the kids, the ghosts, the paintings, they respected her. They were like, let me hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
And that is the story of Professor Minerva McGonagall.
Ugh. Started getting so emotional at the end again.
I did a lot of crying reading just her quotes and like how much she loved those kids.
Yeah. Well, and I love it when it's someone who isn't super warm and fuzzy all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, because you know that you earned it.
Yeah.
Because like those were always the kinds of teachers that I gravitated towards when I was younger.
Mm.
I loved having a teacher who I like needed to prove myself to.
Mm.
Like the teacher that everyone else described as like a bitch, like they're my favorite professors and teachers. So like my mom's a teacher and she's like very warm and fuzzy and like everybody comes in like, and she's a great teacher, but like, you know, I never, well, obviously she's my mom,
she's
too,
your mom,
but
yeah.
Like, but you know, any type of teacher like that, I never felt like I need to do good so you're proud of
me. Right, you want to earn it from
somebody. Yeah, I wanted to earn it. Like, I had a lacrosse coach like that, too. Like, I wanted to earn it.
Yeah.
And I think those types of teachers are so important for certain students,
you know? They're incredible.
Yeah, and I just feel like she's...
I am not that way. I'm just like, yeah, let's talk about Europe.
No, but I'm sure your students have that kind of feeling, too, of like they want to do good by you.
Yeah, they do, absolutely, but... I just think she's a cool story. I think the fact that she's written by a woman is a cool story. I think there's so many undertones in her story that you're like, I wonder, was that meant to be like a feminist dig? Because there was a big, and I'm sure we might talk about this in another episode, there was a big uproar when at the end of the seventh one, Molly Weasley kills Bellatrix and after she shoots a spell at her daughter, and there was like a, this is such like a mother's win, people who don't have kids lose, and it was like, that is not what she was saying, because McGonagall did not have kids and she was very awesome.
Oh yeah.
So I think that people saw that one moment and it was like, no, that was two women fighting in the middle of a war, both extremely powerful witches, and had nothing to do with whether or not they had kids.
Right. Well, and also like, I never thought about this until recently, an episode of Sacred Text, where like, I forgot that in that scene, like, she had already almost lost Ginny once in the Chamber of Secrets.
Yes.
And I never thought about it from that standpoint of, like, not again.
Yeah.
Like, I already almost lost her. Like, you can't have her. Like, you know, and it wasn't exactly like a, you know, you don't have kids, so you don't understand. It's like, no, she was almost taken from me once. Like,
right. And I think it may have been felt like that because Narcissa just had turned her back on her entire side to save her son, or to know that her son is safe.
Yeah.
And like, oh, Voldemort will never understand love. So there's like, there's a lot of, but also J.K. Rowling's mother was dying when she was writing. So I died, I think, in between the fourth and fifth book. So it was like everything changed in that moment. And obviously Harry's super aggressive in the fifth book and angry and just mad at the world. And it's like, you wonder what was coming through her pen that turned into just like, Lily is a fucking godsend. Everybody else get out of here.
Yeah.
So cool story.
Cool story. All right. We need more drink.
New drink. Tell me what you know about Margaret Smith.
Okay. So I know that she is most famous for portraying Professor McGonagall.
Of course.
And I know that she's a British actress. She's been doing it for a long time. Again, like we said, she always plays like stern older woman roles now.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she's just been in so much. But I don't know anything about her personal life. I don't know if she's ever been married. I don't know if she has kids. I don't know anything about her.
Well, I'm going to give you what I can. Maggie Smith is a very private person. Mm-hmm. Even like her biography, which I read sections of, are like, because I needed something personal about her. It's not an autobiography. It's written by someone else. It's a biography. It's straight. It's to the point. It's about her acting. So most of what we know about Maggie is really professional life stuff and what she said in interviews. So I watched a lot of like the Graham Norton show.
Yeah.
And like just tried to get a feel for her. So my sources are Wikipedia, obviously, sections of her biography that's just simply called Maggie Smith, Tea with Dames, which is a cute documentary that came out in like 2019, which was just a cute like girl gab with her and like Judi Dench and a couple other dames that are also actresses. And then there was a really good YouTube video called like The Untold Story of Maggie Smith or something that was only 11 minutes, but it was good.
Oh, good.
Like,
I love
it gave
those.
A lot of good details in like a very short film. Okay. Margaret Natalie Smith.
Natalie?
I know.
I love when I'm just shocked by the mere name of someone.
The middle name, Margaret Natalie Smith, was born December 28th, 1934 in Essex. Her mom, not Essex, Maryland. Dear God, her roots would be brown and her hair would be blonde. Her mom was Margaret Hutton, and she was a secretary from Glasgow, and her dad was Nathaniel Smith, and he was in public health, and he was from Newcastle, and he worked for the University of Oxford. Apparently, her parents had this really adorable meet-cute on a train between Glasgow and London, but again, Maggie's super private, so I don't know a lot about it, just that she brought up that her parents met on this train and fell in love. She and her family moved to Oxford when she was 4 years old, and she has two older brothers who are twins.
Oh.
Her family did not want her to act. That is something that she has brought up a lot. She was born right before World War II and was in her late teens, early 20s, right after World War II and the Great Depression. So acting was kind of seen as an indulgence. And
frivolous.
Yeah, very frivolous for this time period. And she even got in trouble one time for going to the theater with her neighbors on a Sunday. It was like a very, like, you should not have done that. Like, that's outside of, like, what we think we should be as a family.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure also in those times, it's not even, like, what we think we should be, but, like, how the neighbors will see us.
Right.
Like,
how people are going to see us as people.
Yeah. It's like, we're not the type of people who would just let our daughter engage in this, you know, wasteless, you know, or useless activity. Yeah. Like,
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley are perfectly normal. Thank you very much. So she was educated at Oxford High School, and she graduated early when she was 16. Mm. She graduated from high school and went right on to the Oxford Playhouse.
Ooh.
So she's 17-year-old starting her acting career. So what I did is, because she's been in everything and won every single possible award, So what I did is I grouped everything by decade and medium.
Okay.
But it's kind of all at the same time. She is on TV, in the movies, and on stage through her entire multi-decade career. So we're starting in the 1950s and 60s in theater on okay. stage where she got her start. So it's 1952 and little Maggie. Have you ever looked at young pictures of Maggie Smith?
No.
She is right beautiful. Like, look up young Maggie Smith. She's just so adorable. And the internet is full of photos of her because she's been in literally everything. So 17-year-old Maggie Smith gets a... Yes, I'm your mouth agape at these photos. Look at her.
Funny, especially in like this photo, she looks like Natalie Wood.
Yes, she's stunning. I love that photo of her.
Oh my God. Okay, well, that's going in one of the posts.
It has to. It absolutely has to. That's the cocktail post. Oh my Isn't gosh. She beautiful?
And hers a blonde in this one.
I know.
Guys, I know you're gardening and driving, but you should really look up these photos.
They're so stunning. And she's been in so many things that she's had so many looks.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. Yeah. Oh, this is fantastic.
She's so fun to look at. Mm. Okay. So we're going back to 17 years old.
Okay.
She gets a stroke of luck and gets cast as Viola in The Twelfth Night at the Oxford Playhouse. So she just kind of goes on stage and does a great job.
Ugh.
And then she continues to act in productions, Cinderella, Cake of Ale, The Government Inspector, among several others. I'm invoking the Madonna clause. There's absolutely no way I can cover her career.
Also, Madonna's in the hospital right now.
What?
You didn't know that?
No.
Rush to the hospital.
Why didn't you text me immediately?
I assumed you got the news.
Excuse me, what is Madonna's condition?
We don't know. She has like a horrible bacterial infection. She was in the ICU.
This is not okay.
I know.
Is it MRSA?
Dare it be MRSA? We don't know. So yeah, obviously we'll know by the time this releases. So this is going to be really old news.
Oh my.
But yeah.
Madonna clause.
Sorry about that.
Sorry. Wow. I'm going to have to change the name. It's too soon.
Maggie Smith clause. Even though she's
also old. This is the Elizabeth Taylor clause. Yeah. I can't possibly get through everything. Okay. But very quickly, after she has success in Oxford Playhouse, she makes it on Broadway. She like goes to the United States. She is by 1956 in theater productions. On Broadway, New Faces, Share My Lettuce, The Private Eye.
Share My Lettuce.
I don't even understand the name of that one. But she wasn't just cast in these things. She's also starting to get noticed for these things and winning just like some basic standard theater awards. Nothing of note. But she did catch the eye of Laurence Olivier.
Ooh.
Who invites her to be part of the new National Theater Company. So Laurence Olivier is starting a British national traveling theater company, and she is in the inaugural group of actors
with him,
who she calls Larry in interviews.
Larry!
Larry and Maggie! But they quickly strike up a rivalry. They were not good friends.
Oh, no.
Now, they weren't like... enemies, but this is what her biographer said about them. He knew immediately that he'd met his match, that she was extraordinary. But having her in the company, they quickly became not enemies, but professional rivals. Never on stage had anyone been quicker than him, and it became a competition. So she is like young 20s, and she's just so good that I think it is like threatening to him as an actor.
Yeah.
And she's also like bold and speaks to him directly, and he wasn't used to that. So she played opposite him in Othello. And during this production one time, there was a play night that was going really, really poorly, and he was just so frustrated. And she said in an interview that there was this like... stage slap, like he had to slap her, and he just actually slapped her on stage, which is like super abusive.
Yeah.
They like did not like each other.
Damn.
But they acted aside one another in multiple plays, including Much Ado About Nothing. Like they were in many plays together for the multiple years.
Yeah.
But she's also at this time not just traveling and being on stage. She was also in film. Her first film role was unaccredited. She didn't even have a name, whatever. But her first screen credit was for her role as Bridget Howard in Nowhere to Go. And just like everything else in her career, she starts to receive award nominations right away. And she's not in low budget things.
Right.
She was in the VIPs with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
And then Laurence Olivier is going to make a movie for Othello. And he's like, well, the only person who can do it with me is Maggie. Like, we're going to have to do it together.
I love that he's like, I fucking hate her. But also, she's the best person for
the part. The best person for this role.
And let me tell you, that's the person to be in life. Mm-hmm. Be so good that they literally can't deny.
Yeah, even if they hate you. Yeah. Use your, let your work speak for itself, Maggie.
Exactly.
Let it. And that she actually got her first Oscar nomination for this, for Best Supporting Actress. She didn't win, but she got her first. She's pretty young to get an Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
For a British actress doing a Shakespeare movie.
Well, it's also funny to me that she just kind of went right from, like, she just, like, passed over the West End. Like, I feel like usually people start in the West End and then go to Broadway.
Well, I wonder how much this traveling theater company hung out in the West End. You know what I mean? It is the National Theater Company. Because she does do several plays throughout her life in the West End. It just, like, I didn't do a lot of research into what the National Theater Company is. I just know she was a part of it.
Yeah.
So, okay. Early in her career, she's also in many comedies. She was in Go to the Blazes, The Pumpkin Eater, Young Cassidy, Hot Millions, Oh, What a Lovely War. And these are all movies. And I let this account for her perfect timing.
Yeah.
Like,
agreed.
She is so funny, even in dramatic roles. Like when she's telling Harry Potter and Ron Weasley to transform themselves into a map. And she's like, well, how about a pocket watch? She is so, her timing is impeccable. And like, I felt the same way in Downton Abbey. She is like a villainess in that show.
Really? I've never seen it.
Well, she's like the Dowager Duchess. So she's the mother of the Duke that owns like this area. And he has three daughters and he's trying to marry his daughters well. We'll talk about it later. But we'll talk about it now, I mean. Oh,
I thought you meant like just the two of us, but like we're going to get into it in this story. Okay.
No. Like, I'll talk about it a little bit later. I had to glaze over everything. But she, like, is kind of like, doesn't want to hand the money and the family stuff over to so-and-so, but she has very little power because she's a woman. But her timing is so funny. I can't believe it. It's so good. I don't know. Mm. If you have not watched Downton Abbey, which Jake and I never finished it because they took it off of Netflix
when we
were halfway through. So now we have to like purchase it because we both were really into it. It was very good.
Oh, I'm going
to
watch it. Okay.
Yeah, it's very good. It was definitely worth it.
Okay.
Okay. So perfect timing. She's a comedian. Also, she does sing. For those of you who don't know, she's a very good like songstress. Now, she's very self-deprecating about her own voice because like she's not like a Julie Andrews, but she's really good.
I mean, it's hard for any British singer nowadays.
Of course.
Because you're always going to be compared to Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like if we were all compared to Britney Spears. We could never.
How could I?
You think I'm going to wrap that snake around my shoulders? Absolutely not.
I'm a snake. No, the only one they play at the grocery store is Lucky. What are they doing with that? Every time I'm in Giant, she's so lucky. She's a star. I love that. Okay.
That's funny.
Yes.
Okay. That song came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we were friends.
It's on the Slave for You album.
We were friends by then.
we were official friends by then. Like, actual.
I remember at some point, like, you were like, you know what's really annoying? You're like, the popular girls never get a story of them. This is before Mean Girls came out.
Oh.
And you're like, it's really hard to be popular.
It is.
And they're like, you're like, they never make like movies or stories about how hard it is to be popular. And I was thinking about the Lucky song and I was like, all right, I'm going to write a story about like how hard it is to be popular girl.
Hell yeah.
And you know, it's funny. I named the main character Claire Underwood.
No, you didn't.
I did. Because Claire was the richest girl name I could possibly think of.
And Underwood is close to your last name.
Well, no, Underwood was the name of the company that made the typewriter that sat in my mother's library.
It's okay. Greenwood is the name of the towing company from our neighborhood.
Isn't it so
that
funny?
That is so funny.
Of House of Cards fame, Claire Underwood.
Robin Wright, you've made it.
You made it.
You made it, Robin.
Is that weird, though?
That is very weird. Also didn't know that happened to you. I'm sorry.
I took everything you said like as if it were like my personal Bible when I was a kid. I was like,
because you
I'm
had
gonna make
no
Ellie's
sisters.
Dreams come true. I'm going to write this story for her.
It is very hard to be popular. It's like, okay, also, I want to be very, very clear. Anytime you're at church, they're like, if you're wealthy, fuck you. Yeah. Like, every Bible verse is like, you're meek, you're weak, you're poor, you are blessed. Everyone.
That's how you know I went to real, real churches and not these pop culture ones.
I cannot believe it. They love the blue collar in church. They love it.
As they should.
I'm not anti-blue collar. Just I want some Caesars and Herods that are like blessed as well. Somebody give me a good king.
Anyways, that was a terrible, terrible tangent, and I do apologize.
It was a beautiful tangent. Okay.
Okay.
In June of 1976, she marries actor Robert Stevens. They're married for about 8 years and have two sons together. Both of these boys are in the performing arts. They're actors in England, and they are in movies and plays and whatnot. They're doing very well for themselves. But the reason I bring this up now is they're married for 8 years, and maybe the next minute of me talking, keep in mind, she was getting married, having two babies, and getting divorced while all this is happening.
Oh, my God.
So she's, like, really on her game. Mm. So she stayed with the theater company in the UK for 8 years, and she's growing, and she's learning, and she even goes and does this Shakespeare Festival where she had already been in Othello, but at the Shakespeare Festival, she plays Cleopatra in Cleopatra and Antony. She plays Queen Elizabeth in Richard III, and then she plays Lady Macbeth in Macbeth.
Oh, my God.
All in the same festival.
That's crazy.
And despite the fact that she already got an Oscar nomination for Othello and then does all this amazing stuff, she said it on a show when people asked her about it. Oh, it was in The Guardian. Shakespeare's not really my thing. But because being a Shakespearean actor is so high tier
right.
in Great Britain, mm-hmm. I think that like she's like, that's not what I'm great at. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm good at it. Mm-hmm. Like, who's the guy who plays... the crazy professor in the second movie. Can you see me? Can you hear me? Professor Lockhart.
Oh, Gilderoy Lockhart.
Yeah, yes. He is a super famous Shakespearean actor in England.
Oh, okay.
So that they picked him for that purposeful reason that he would be very like stage-esque. Yeah, and that's just not who she is.
Yeah.
So she is going back and forth. She's on Broadway. She's in comedic roles. And some of the critics are like, she is so great at body acting. They talk about her like lurching herself around, kind of like Kramer from Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. She's like running on the stage and spinning in between things. And she actually wins a Tony for the play The Private Life and then gets a nomination for Day and Night on Broadway just a couple years later. So she's already into the Tonys in the 1970s. In terms of television, her early career is just like guest spots here and there, including she has a guest spot on the Carol Burnett Show. But then she gets a full role in All for Love and wins a BAFTA for it, her first BAFTA.
It's exciting.
It is. After her divorce, she very quickly, like within the same year, she gets divorced in 1975 and then remarried in 1975.
Whoa.
To a playwright named Beverly Cross, and they just get married at the registrar office. It's just like low-key, let's not talk about it. And they're married up until his death. So
really?
Her second husband,
oh, wow.
And they never have kids. She's got her two sons with her first husband, and then she's married to this guy forever. She wins her first Oscar for her role in Prime of Miss Jean Brody for, like, Best Actress.
What?
I know.
She has an Oscar?
She has two Oscars.
What?
I know. And she doesn't have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
That's a tragedy.
We looked her up. Now, some people turn them down.
Oh.
So okay. I don't know if she was offered a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, but Daniel Radcliffe has one.
Yeah.
She had to have turned it down.
I would think so.
And although, and also it might have to be, and now she has two Oscars and like a lot of Tonys and stuff. So like, I also wonder if like you had to make an impact in Hollywood, and a lot of her impact is in England and in New York. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that's like a little bit of the difference, although the Oscar stage is in Hollywood. So like, I don't know. Okay. All through the 70s and 80s, she's in movies and comedies and dramas. Of note, she is in Death on the Nile with Angela Lansbury and Betty Davis. She's in the original Clash of the Titans. And then she has an appearance in the movie called Room with a View, where she stars with Helena Bonham Carter, Daniel Day-Lewis, Judi Dench, et cetera, et cetera. She's like keeping good company.
Hold on, I'm sorry.
Room with a View.
The movie or the...
The movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I didn't realize she was in that.
And it, I mean, she repeats acting with a lot of these famous British actors because every famous British actor was asked to be in Harry Potter.
Really?
Yeah. And although she has a lot of famous people co-stars, there was a dark comedy she was in called A Private Function, and there were pigs in the film. They used all female pigs at 6 months old, so they weren't too like big and aggressive like pigs get, like potbelly pigs. But during one of the scenes, a pig like trapped Maggie in the corner, and she had to like jump over it to get away.
Oh my god.
But in the late 80s, Maggie was diagnosed with Graves' disease, for which she had to undergo radiotherapy and optical surgery. If you've ever wondered why her eyes are so pronounced, it's part of Graves' disease. No. Your eyes like bug out, and she had to get like an optical surgery and do all this radiotherapy and this thyroid treatment to like keep her from dying. Oh, Maggie's fine. And I think it's actually one of the most beautiful things about her face.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, it is one of the repercussions of this disease that she has.
You know, it's funny. I was just watching a thing today about Elijah Wood and how like, he's very, very famous for like his big blue eyes. Big blue eyes. And, but apparently he has terrible eyesight. And one of the Finn and Pippin or whatever their names are, Merry and Pippin. One of the actors was like, I think it was because he was just like born and he couldn't see. So he was just trying to like see, and he just kept pushing his eyes out.
I was like, see what was going on. Yeah, that's exactly right. Merry and Pippin.
Maybe that's what happened to Dame Maggie.
I love that you said Finn and Pippin, because I'm thinking about Colin and Finn, who isn't one of them from New Zealand on Gilmore Girls. I think that's what you're going for, yeah, like in your head. A similar thing. Little side boy characters. Okay. All through the 80s and 90s, she is in famous plays on Broadway, on the West End. She plays Virginia Woolf in Virginia.
Oh my
gosh. I know. So in lieu of talking about all the things she does in these plays, I decided to pull a couple quotes of critics of her plays.
Okay.
One says, there is only one Maggie Smith, but audiences get at least three of her. That's adorable.
That's really cute.
One says, Maggie Smith has to be seen to be believed.
Oh my gosh.
And then the last one says, this actress continues to get laughs where no one else would, but her quiet is just as revealing. Get out of here. I'm sorry.
Exciting.
She does do a straight-to-TV movie in the 90s called Memento Mori, where she gets nominated for her first primetime Emmy. She doesn't win, but she gets nominated for an Emmy. Once she gets an Emmy, she has the acting triple crown at this point. But more notably, in 1999, she was in the television adaptation of Charles Dickens' novel, David Copperfield. This is crucial because this is the first time you see Maggie Smith acting with a young brown-haired boy who doesn't quite have his glasses yet. And Maggie is actually responsible for suggesting Daniel Radcliffe for the role of Harry Potter.
Got chills.
I know. She acted with him in this film in 1999.
She acted with Daniel Radcliffe in this
film. In 1999.
I didn't know that.
And then she goes on to suggest him to the casting directors.
Oh my God.
Like, go seek out this boy. He was really great. I guess he had a good temperament on set. Because in 1999, he would have been very young.
Yeah.
He's like around my age. So,
like younger than me even.
I think he's younger than
me. Yeah. Because Emma Thompson is younger than me. I think Rupert Grint's the oldest. He's around my age.
Yeah.
But like it's not Emma Thompson. Of course she's older than me. Emma Watson. Emma Thompson is Professor Trelawney. Also amazing. But yeah, so she's in this film with little baby Daniel Radcliffe.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that that's how he got his start.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's 33. So he's Marjorie and Casey.
Yes.
Casey's age.
Casey's age, yeah. Perfect. So yeah, it's so fun. Isn't that fun?
I love that.
Okay. In the 90s, in terms of movies, this is where she brought home the big bucks. And this is the Maggie that Katie and I grew up with. Uh-huh. And we fucking love her. She is a queen. Number one, she is Granny Wendy in Hook, opposite Robin Williams, which she did a great job, like, using her big blue eyes to, like, look off into the distance. And also, I wish there were retroactive Oscars because they put age makeup on her for that film. And now she looks like that. So like spot on, guys. Good job. That film brought in $300 million in the box office. And that's like early 90s. That was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Then she's a Mother Superior in Sister Act and Sister Act 2. Arguably a better movie, Sister Act 2. Alongside Whoopi Goldberg and Lauryn Hill. And I am obsessed with her as that nun. What?
I'm obsessed with just Sister Act as a movie.
Sister Act 2. Listen, I cannot talk to you about their performance of Joyful Joyful without singing it. So be prepared. The rat break in the middle. Joyful Joyful. Lord, we are the You down with me. Yo, G-O-D.
I feel like I'm not going to get into it. And then you immediately went into it. I was more familiar with the My Guy to My God transition.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Because I dressed in a poodle skirt and performed that at my church.
Of course you did.
You know whose poodle skirt it was? Carrie Barrett.
Carrie Barrett? Oh, my friend. Damn it. Her mom's birthday is tomorrow. Happy birthday, Aunt Patsy. We just full named them. You can find them online anywhere you go.
At Aunt Patsy on.
Just stop. Find Aunt Patsy.
She's very good at math.
The best at math, arguably.
Yeah. She's like the Dame Maggie Smith of math.
She might be. Woo! Okay, so then she was in the Five Wives Club with Goldie Hawn, Diane Keaton, Bette Midler. I mean, come on.
She was in that movie?
Yes.
That's another movie. Wait, what did you say?
The Five Wives Club.
First Wives Club.
First Wives Club is what I meant.
That's one of those movies I have not seen, and I can't believe I haven't seen it because it has so many of my favorite people.
I mean, it's one of those movies where it's just like iconic and you want to sit down and watch it, but then when you go to sit down and watch it, you're like, I'm not ready.
Right, yeah.
I feel like I'm not prepared for this.
Right. But now I feel like as a current first wife, maybe I can.
Yeah, I think you should.
Maybe I can.
It's time. It's time. Oh, wait. That was the Jurassic Park song. I meant to do the Lion King song.
You remember when they saw the dinosaur? It's time.
Oh, I hate myself. Okay. And then she goes on to win a couple Oscars for Tea at Mussolini's, Last September, Curtain Call. Who cares? All right. Now we're into the 2000s. In 2002, Maggie, do you say 2002 or 2002?
2002.
Ah, damn. I always say and. Like, it's a thing. I said 2002. Why did I say that? Okay. Stupid. In 2002.
I say 22.
But that's a wrong year. I'm talking about the past. The past should stay right where it belongs, there. In 2002, Maggie reunited with her best friend on stage, Judi Dench, and they did The Breath of Life, which, again, critics didn't love this play, but they said in the paper the exception was Maggie Smith, who arrives in the last minute of the first act and then dominates the second. Like, she just brought the play up as a whole just by, like, existing.
I love that.
I know. And if Maggie was not already famous enough, she joined a star-studded cast playing a most loved character in a most loved children's book series of all time.
She was in 7 of the 8 Harry Potter films as Professor McGonagall, reuniting with Daniel Radcliffe.
Wait, 7 of the 8?
Yeah, so the first half of the Deathly Hallows,
yeah,
they were never at Hogwarts. So a lot of the teachers, nice, like, I think you see a glimpse of Snape, but like a lot of the teachers aren't in that one.
Weird.
They didn't even, yeah, because they're like existing in the background of our brains, mm-hmm, but they're never actually in the film.
Huh, bananas.
Okay. Yeah. These movies purposefully, and if you're a big Harry Potter fan, this is something that's often talked about, they hired legendary and elite British actors to bolster up the children's performances, because mm-hmm, kids are just not as good at acting. So to make it more real, they picked very, very talented people who are award-ridden. Like, they're just stacked with awards, mm-hmm, all the adults in the film. But from the moment that she steps into that entranceway in front of the Great Hall, you are captivated by her, because Maggie did not play Minerva McGonagall. She is,
yeah,
Minerva McGonagall. Without inflation, Harry Potter is the third highest grossing film of all time, with $7.7 billion worldwide.
Oh my God. That's the first one?
No, of all the series. Like the highest grossing, oh, okay, series.
The highest grossing
all,
series.
Third, okay, highest grossing series of all time. So it would be in competition with like Star Wars,
Star Wars,
Indiana,
okay,
Jones. Yeah, Marvel. Things, okay, like that. During the filming of these movies in 2007, Maggie was diagnosed with breast cancer. She had to go through radiology and wears a wig in some of the movies because her hair fell out.
Oh my God.
In many scenes, especially in Half-Blood Prince, you can see her holding onto railings while she's delivering her lines because she literally couldn't stand there while she was acting. But she made it full to a full recovery, mm-hmm, so that in Deathly Hallows Part 2, she could fight off Severus Snape in the Great Hall like a badass.
Perfect.
I know. Best scene. She shares often about working on the films and that sometimes it was tiring and frustrating because when you act with kids, A, they're goofy, and B, they have to have a certain amount of breaks every,
right,
day.
Yeah.
So what you have is some of the most famous, successful actors of all time sitting around waiting. They're getting paid to sit there. She said that people like her and Alan Rickman just had to sit in the background at the head table in a lot of shots, and they let the kids do the acting, and then the camera would spin to them for a reaction shot. She goes, after a while, I ran out of faces. She's like, I didn't have any more reaction faces. I didn't know what to do.
Oh my gosh.
Because that's all she was doing. She was teaching in front of a room, and like, some of her great parts where she's actually acting don't come until the very end where she's actually in the battle scenes, mm-hmm, fighting the Death Eaters.
Yeah.
Especially her. Like, I feel like Alan Rickman had more to do. Hagrid had, or Robbie Coltrane had, yeah, more to do. Dumbledore, mm-hmm, what's his name? Michael Gambit had more. They had more to do. She was just very, like, by the book.
Right. There, you know, weren't many outside of teaching scenes.
With her. She's the quintessential teacher.
Yeah. Which is funny because you brought this up recently that Robbie Coltrane, who played Hagrid,
yeah,
was really crucial for the kids because he was in so many scenes with all three of them. Mm-hmm. And I never thought about that until, yeah, you brought it up. And
he was like an uncle.
Shit. Yeah. It's so sweet.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, however, Maggie does have 5 grandchildren, aww, who loved her as Professor McGonagall. They were like blown away that she was in all the Harry Potter films. And I don't know where she found the energy, because during Harry Potter and cancer treatment, she was in Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood. She was in Becoming Jane. She was in Nanny McPhee. She's in all these very famous movies. In terms of television, she did finally win her primetime Emmy for lead actress in this series called My House Umbria. And she also got 8 Golden Globe nominations for that film.
Wow.
And it was, she also starred in Capturing Mary on HBO.
So she's an EBOT.
Yes.
Because she's won an Emmy, a BAFTA, uh-huh, an Oscar, and a
She's
Tony.
Won all of the acting awards.
Yes.
No vocal awards.
Yeah.
Now, all she has to do is read an audiobook.
Literally, yes.
Just narrate the first Harry Potter as a special, yeah, bonus, and you'll win something.
And then she could be a BIGOT.
The best of them.
Mm-hmm.
A BIBAGOT. The best BAFTA, yeah, Oscar. Tony.
Her most famous television appearance of late is on the hit Downton Abbey, where Maggie appears as Violet Crawley, the Dowager Countess of Grantham. This is a British period drama, which became super popular between 2010 and 2015 when it was on. Her character is a fan favorite because everybody watching the show knows and loves Maggie. And we all know her at this point as a semi-wicked, conniving, but also smartly cute and witty great aunt of sorts. She said on the Graham Norton show that she never watched it. She never watched it back. And he asked, why was she disappointed? And she said, no, I just don't have enough time left in my life to watch Downton Abbey. Like, I'm like towards the end. I'm not going to sit down and watch this show. I was there.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'm not watching it. She also said, though, of her performances as Professor McGonagall and Violet, that they were not hard roles for her, and she didn't even really feel like she was acting. She just kind of like showed up and was herself, and she loves the theater way, way, way more. She prefers being on stage.
Yeah.
For this character, she won 3 Emmys, a Golden Globe, and a SAG Award. And then in 2015, she announced she was not going to return to the show. She was like, this is my last season. I just can't do it anymore. And they actually just stopped the show after that season. They were just like, whatever. Without Maggie Smith, who cares? Yeah. While filming, though, she did lose her husband of the last several decades. God. In 2013. And she describes herself as lonely now. She says it seems a bit pointless going on one's own and not having someone to share it with. It's sad.
Yeah, that is sad.
She did make her way back to theater, though. They asked her to join in on the 50-year anniversary of the National Live Theater for Britain. And her being in the inaugural group, it was a big deal for her to come back to do that 50-year anniversary. Her last performance to date on stage was in A German Life at the Bridge Theater in London. And that was in 2019, pre-epidemic. She's acted with, many critically acclaimed movies recently, but the biggest one she did was the Downton Abbey movie that they put together to kind of finish off the storyline. And that was $193.4 million that they made. In 2018, and I watched this cute documentary, in Britain, it was called Nothing Like a Dame, and she sat down with herself, obviously, Judi Dench, Eileen Atkins, and Joan Plowright, and they just sat and, like, spilled the tea about their life. If you want to watch it in the U.S., it's called Tea with Dames. It's just a cute gap fest. In terms of charity, she's donated money to rebuild a theater in New Zealand after an earthquake. She's also a patron of the Oxford Playhouse. She contributed a drawing of her hand to the Celebrity Paw auction, which was to raise money for cats, which is adorable because Professor McGonagall is a cat. And then during 2020, she participated in a celebrity Zoom reading of different Shakespeare. I mentioned several awards, but I really wanted to put them all together so that we would understand the breadth of her career. She is a Dame of the British Empire. She is a member of the Order of the Companions of Honor. She has 4 honorary doctorates and 1 honorary fellowship. She has 6 nominations and 2 wins for Academy Awards. She has several Tony nominations and 1 Tony, 4 Primetime Emmys, 5 British Academy Film Awards, 3 Golden Globes, 5 SAG Awards, a record 7 BAFTAs, and several different awards that are just named after people. Like, she has the Laurence Olivier Award. She's in the...
Weird, because she was, like, a contemporary of his.
Yeah. She's in the British Theater Hall of Fame, the American Theater Hall of Fame. She's got a lot of Shakespeare awards. And obviously, because she's a dame, most recently, she attended the coronation of King Charles III. But Maggie does not plan on retiring. In an interview after the movie where she played Violet from Downton Abbey, they asked her about retiring, and she said, I'll keep going as Violet and then as any other old biddy that comes along.
I love
that. And that is the story. That's the story of Maggie Smith. I wanted to call the cocktail old biddy, but I didn't want people to think I was being disrespectful. So Dame Maggie, colon, old biddy.
I love that.
That's her story so far. And I mean, she's still kicking.
I can't believe she's still alive.
I know.
Because what? She's born in 35?
Yeah, she's in her 80s.
34. She was born in 34.
34. Okay.
So she'll be 90 next year. I know. She's really doing it. I'm so proud of her. Ugh,
fantastic. All right. Well, we have to get more cocktails and talk about more famous women in show business.
Showbiz. Showbiz night. Did we roll out a red carpet? You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.